Welcome to Speak Up International with Rita Burke and Elton Brown.
Today, it gives me great pleasure to introduce a homegrown, and I say international, designer, Kendra Francis. Now, Kendra began her career at the age of 13 and was self-taught. So by the time she started with Ryerson, she was on her way to fashion designing. She's currently the brain and name behind Frankie, which is a luxury apparel label, and is considered one of Toronto's hottest respected designer. To our listeners, meet Miss Kendra Francis.
Hello, everyone. Hi, how are you?
I think we're doing well. Thank you for asking and welcome to Speak Up International.
Thank you for having me.
Right off of that, what is your signature style as a fashion designer?
For me, I enjoy tailoring. I enjoy menswear tailoring, and that's probably because I learned a lot from my father, who learned from his father, who was a tailor. So my look would be modern contemporary. I like the tailoring. I like the form-fitting style, but very chic in the luxury space, like upscale day wear to evening wear. Yeah, that's where I fit in the women's wear side. But I also have a children's line as well. So that children's line is more classic styles. It's not sweats. It's not trendy. It's like classic bonnets and rompers, stuff that would more be along the lines of a heirloom sort of piece that you can pass on and every baby looks cute and it goes from 0 to 24 months. So, you know, you always have those cute, before they can decide what they want to wear, before they're telling you they don't want to wear it. Yeah.
Sounds exciting. When I have my children, of course, there was no children's line. You went somewhere
right.
And you bought clothes for children.
Right.
But I have a question. You said in your bio, Kendra, mm-hmm. that sewing is in your blood. It's in your DNA. I want you to mm-hmm. expand on that statement for us, please.
So firstly, my grandfather was a tailor and my father is from Dominica. And his dad was a tailor in their town. And he made all the uniforms for the fire department and for the police department. And through, you know, the tales of, you know, our uncles and everybody, a lot of my uncles and my dad's friends, they came up sort of interning in the tailor shop. So a lot of them know how to sew and to tailor. My dad's brother actually was a tailor by trade. My dad wasn't, but he knew how to sew. He knew he was the perfect presser, you know, he knew how to do the perfect welt pocket. So as I discovered fashion design, and then I had my first cousins, my uncle who was a tailor, his daughters, they would sew their own clothes and they'd come home with their Vogue patterns and they'd make their dresses to go to church and they'd make their dresses for different, you know, events and stuff like that. So I took that on and I used to take Vogue patterns and cut them and, you know, repurpose them. I'd always, Kensington Market was a big haunt for me and taking clothes apart and seeing how they're made inside and then remaking them to fit myself. So that's how I taught myself. My dad was always there to help me. He had the big sewing machine at home. My mom used to make clothes for me as well. You know, when I had my fashion shows, my parents would be there backstage clipping threads. My dad would be pressing everything to perfection. My dad would, you know, be the one helping me make the perfect welt pocket on a suit or a pant. So that's why, I mean, it's like in my blood. Like I've been watching it and participating in it for as long as I remember.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing. I think in our culture, a lot of things are passed down. Mm-hmm. They're not some type of formal education. And we learn from doing, which I think in a lot of ways is far better to learn that way as opposed to having books and sitting there having to learn all this theory.
Yeah, practical learning. I mean, then it just becomes muscle memory. You know, you see, you feel, you touch, you can activate the process and then you learn that way.
Speaking of learning, you went to Ryerson. So yes. What did you take away from that experience?
Fashion school is, you know, it sounds, oh, school for fashion. I don't know what the average person thinks about it, but it's very demanding. We actually had more in-class hours than the engineering program. And we were there day and night. And they were hard and they were exacting. You know, you do your shirt sample for class. So the project is, the assignment is a shirt. And that red marker would come out and every little 1/8 of an inch off, he'd circle it in front of the class next and just be destroying your work. It's like architecture, especially when you're doing pattern making. Everything is to the exacting. You take off 1/8 of an inch, 1/8 of an inch. If you're off, then what you're working on does not work out. So the learning graphic design, learning perspective, learning all the different classes we have. I just knew how specific, how tight, how exacting it has to be, how much of an art it actually is in that way. So it just sort of amped up how, you know, precise and how clean and how perfect I knew I had to be in order to put out the best work.
You have to be perfect to put out the best work. I like that. It's called excellence. I'm not sure if we can label it Black excellence, or perhaps we can. So were there many people that looked like you in that designing course at Ryerson?
There were a few, not a lot. I remember one girl named Karen. There was a few, but definitely not a lot. And because of the intensity of the program, you know, we had 70% dropout rate by Christmas, you know, because it is hard. It's long hours. Like when you have to hand in an assignment, you know, you have to hand it on the hour. And people would be helping each other that couldn't finish. And there'd be a line from the door where you had to throw your work in. And everyone would be passing and you just like throw it in the door because she would shut that door right on the hour. And if it wasn't in, then that was a fail.
Was it a challenge? Was the program a challenge?
It was a challenge, yeah.
Why did you stay?
Because that's all I wanted to do. I grew up like Sunday mornings, we'd go into my parents' room and we'd watch Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, Grace Kelly. We'd watch all those old movies. And I was just fascinated by their dresses and their wardrobe and their handbags. And that was the world. I watched, you know, I was obsessed with fashion television. I videotaped it. We had VHS back then. So videotaped them all the time. PBS used to have documentaries on Coco Chanel and Dior, all in black and white, you know, all of those things. I videotaped any kind of information on fashion. That's all I wanted to do. I knew that's what I wanted to do. My parents, even though I sewed and they saw me, like, you know, I made my own prom dress. I made everything. They were surprised that I was going to fashion because I also was good in biology and science. And so I had extra credits in science and they wanted me to go to Queens and do science. I applied to Ryerson in secret, off to the side, put together my portfolio secretly. Woke up super early in the morning, had my boyfriend drive me down, flying on the Gardner to get me to my interview. And I did all that in secret and got accepted to Ryerson because for them, tailoring was not a career. They didn't see it as that, you know? And that's how I got into Ryerson on but I still did the whole thing, like applied to Queens, applied to Western, went to see the campuses and everything, but I knew that's not where I wanted to go.
Can you tell us a little bit about the SS04 collection and how that lifted your career?
Spring, summer 2004. That one was done, it got me on the cover of the Toronto Star fashion section. So back then, for all the young people listening, we did not have Instagram. We had to wait a week to get the review, and you would cross your fingers and hope you would get a review. There's only like 4 pages in the fashion section. So there's only, you know, a certain amount of slots, people that would actually get that accreditation, you know. And I very rarely showed in the tent in Toronto for the fashion. I showed in my shop. So I had my own shop and I would do my own private showings there, because the price to pay to show for the FDTC was very expensive. So I would do the show in my shop. And I made it on the front cover of the paper. And the major editor at that time, or fashion editor, Bernadette Morrow, the whole front page of the fashion section was my collection in the store, beautiful photograph. And it was Fashion Week, Toronto Fashion Week. This got me in a lot of trouble though. Toronto Fashion Week is no longer week, W-E-A-K, because of Kendra Francis. And that was amazing for me, but I got a lot of backlash from the FDCC at that time. And I had to like call, and they wanted an apology. And it was like, I didn't write it. Like, that wasn't something I said. That was something that was written about me. But yes, I got a lot of backlash from that. And to your question about a lot of people like me in the program, there were not a lot of people like me showing in Fashion Week. It was myself. I was the only Black female designer for a long time. I did a reality TV show. I did Project Runway, the first season of Project Runway Canada, where Iman was the host. And there was another Black designer, Shernette, and she was not from Toronto. I believe she was from another province. Sorry, I can't remember exactly. And until I did that show, and then she sort of moved to Toronto and opened a boutique, I was the only Black female designer showing during the calendar for my entire career.
And what was that like for you to be the only Black designer?
Well, it doesn't matter now. Back then, I got a lot of backlash because I spoke up about a lot of things. I spoke up about, you know, the cost of showing a fashion week was exorbitant for someone who didn't. But then a lot of the top designers who I knew, who graduated from Ryerson as well, who were sort of my elders at that time, senior, more senior than me, they weren't asked to pay because they were bigger names. So some people got their spots comped, some people didn't have to pay, some people, there was all, you know, different sort of relationships going on. And I remember speaking about it in an article. I think they called me from one of the publications, I'm not too sure which one. And oh my goodness, I got calls because I had just done Project Runway Canada. I got calls from Brian Bailey, from different people. It's like, why did you say that? Like, why are you talking to the head of the FDCC was very upset with me. So the next show, you know, L'Oreal was the huge sponsor then. She pulled my makeup and she pulled my hair. She wouldn't allow L'Oreal to do my makeup and she wouldn't allow the sponsor hair team to work on my hair. And at the last minute, I had to decide, oh my gosh, okay, I got to make hats. I got to do something because I couldn't find a hair team in time to do the hair. My show was offsite. She wouldn't allow them to cough up. The one good thing is, and it's so long ago, I don't remember her name, but I remember the person who was in charge of L'Oreal Cosmetics, who was heading the team for the Fashion Week. She called me and she said, we are here for the designers. I don't care what they're saying. We're here to help you guys and we will be at your show to do the makeup. So that saved me. But yeah, I had to find very creative ways to get people to come to my show. You know, I would get, one time I had a sponsor, I think it's not Uber, what was it called? Those cars where you kind of pay, like if you live in the city and you don't own a car, you can, you know, rent a car for a few moments, you know, you go pick them up at the lot, those things that was just coming into the city, and they sponsored. And so we would send those cars to pick up the editors from their show to just to make it convenient to come to my show. And then, cause it was offsite, and then they could take those same cars and go to the next show just to ensure that we would get people, you know, tried to get the creative director of, Holt Renfrew to come, you know, so it was hard to get those people to come.
I hear determination. I hear resilience. I hear pluck. I hear confidence. Were you always like this, or where did you learn those traits?
You know, it's so funny because I wouldn't, you know, at those times, I wouldn't be like, oh, I was the most confident. I don't think I felt that way, but I was just, this is what I was doing. So I just had to find a way to do it. One time, Hope Renfrew, at the beginning of every fashion week, they would have like a brunch, a breakfast, host a Hope Renfrew breakfast in their department store on Bloor Street. And so this one season, I couldn't afford to do an actual show. So I got these Brazilian drummers. They were friends of mine. They had a Brazilian drum squad. I got some models, dressed up, hair, makeup. We had the van around the corner. And we had them. There used to be Ashley, on Bloor Street across from Hope Renfrew. And I think it's called the Manulife Center. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called? Yeah, the Manulife Center. And I had the models parading as the editors and stuff were coming into Holt Renfrew. I had the drummers drumming, the models parading up and down on Bloor Street in front of Ashley to create some sort of attention. I think I had seen something like that happen in New York City. So I was like, okay, I'll try that. You know, I tried any form of trying to get people to see. That's when I had energy and chutzpah. I don't know if I would say those things now, but I had a lot of energy, a lot of chutzpah, and a lot of imagination.
I know that probably was a attention grabber, to say the least. What celebrities were you able to work with under your brand?
So back then, getting celebrities was mostly if I knew. Some people, I didn't really have that sort of like PR connection so that they could have, it was just people that I knew that would just reach out and call me because they had heard of me. So I worked with a lot of up and coming artists. I worked a lot with the talent from Much Music, like the VJs. So, you know, the award seasons, I would dress them. There's a few, there's an actress now, her name is Yaya Da Costa, but back then she was new and fresh. So I dressed her for the red carpet, Canadian Sarah Polley, who's a legend here in Toronto. So she was on the voting committee for the Cannes Film Festival. So I made some clothing for her to go to Cannes. There's a young, she's like Korean and Black R&B artist named A. Marie. And then a lot of people would pull stuff for photo shoots. I remember one of my dresses, Karen Kane, our Canadian ballerina, and she wore my dress on the cover of, a magazine. So more like local Canadian celebrities and stuff like that, that people would call me to dress, and clothing for editorials for magazine shoots and stuff.
Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with the Shopping Channel?
So the Shopping Channel came out as a result of me being on Project Runway Canada. And the mentor on Project Runway was Brian Bailey. And my store was on Queen Street West, was probably 10 stores away from Brian Bailey's store as well. And after the opportunity of being on Project Runway, he was helping a lot of us. He was very helpful to me. He purchased my first industrial sewing machine for me. And some of the other designers were getting, he was working with the Shopping Channel because he has his collection on the Shopping Channel. And he got us the ability to, the ability to work there as well. So that process was really, really interesting, producing something for mass production and working with them, and, the costing of something in that way versus was much different than me just pricing something for my own boutique, and working on it. So it was like finding a manufacturer and working with a manufacturing team and doing my technical sheets and going in there and being on production. My mom and my second mom, which is our neighbor that we grew up with, they would come to the factory and we'd be making sure that the stickers were on the packaging. It was just a different process, like how you label it, how you get it to, the Shopping Channel on time, the purchase order, the quantity was huge. All the sewers working, you know, how you had to compromise your design a bit because, you know, you had to fit into a pricing and what their customer would want. So the collection wasn't really my signature look because it had to fit into what the shopping channel's customer base was. But that whole process was a big learning in order to get to the level of mass, you know, production and producing things, not on such a small scale.
Kendra Francis, Speak Up International seeks to inspire, to inform, and to educate. And there's no question that your story is doing all of those things. Now, here you are, a designer, a Black woman, with a business on Queen Street West. Talk about that for our listeners, please.
So that was a very ballsy move because I didn't have any money. So it was like, I found this space and, you know, you just have all these like, oh, I'll just open up my own boutique. And this is a great space. You know, it was a new up and coming neighborhood. The Drake hadn't been built yet. So many things hadn't been built yet, but I found this shop and I just wanted it. So I put together a presentation. It's so funny that I say this because I'm just realizing my son does this to me now. When he wants something, he puts together a PowerPoint presentation to convince me of what he wants. And I never told him this, but I did the same thing for my parents. I did the same thing for the landlord at the time because I was just a girl that just wanted to design. You know, I didn't have any history of ownership or anything like that. And so I put together the presentation. I put together a mood board of how I wanted to look and the concept and the style of the whole thing and what I wanted to generate from this shop. And I presented it to the landlord. It was like 5 pages. And I presented it to my parents to convince them to give me the money to open up the shop. So everyone got convinced by that presentation because the landlord said yes. And he was like, oh, we have like 27 applications for this place, but because of the concept or what you presented, you know, we love it. And his wife was into fashion, and so she loved the idea. And then my parents took a little longer to be convinced. It wasn't that easy, but they, you know, they put up the money and I opened up the shop, and every creative thing I could possibly do in that store, I did. It was like almost like a creative hub, not just a store. I redid the basement. So I lived in the basement. My dad helped me. We built cedar lined closets because we built bedroom. I had washer dryer. I had my studio downstairs in the basement and you could enter from the back in the laneway. And then the store was just my creative outlet. I would write quotes from Machiavelli on the window, you know, and I'd have my boyfriend at that time out there just putting, I'd be like, nope, this way, like find the quote, and he'd have to perfectly paint it onto the window. And it garnered so much attention, people would stop. I think I got written up in the Globe and Mail for the quotes that I had on the window. Like I said, I would do my showcases in the boutique. I opened up a day spa beneath so my clients could get like manicure, pedicure. So we used to do bridesmaids and bridal parties in there. Sex in the City was big at the time. So I used to get copies of the episode like a week after it came out in the States, because it wasn't like now where you can get, obviously there's no streaming. You couldn't get it right away. It was on HBO. So I'd get a copy of it from a friend of mine and I'd play it, and we'd have like cocktails and manicures in the shop, and clients could get discounts. So I was actually one of the first people to create that, to, you know, do that concept of in-store sort of activations. It was experiential, like everything that they have, the, you know, that they say now, experiential, you know, activations. Mm-hmm. I was doing that then, which was like 2000, to get people to come into the store. So there's always something happening there. And there was one other girl, her name was Alexia, Black girl, amazing girl. She had a store. So there was two of, she was further east. So she was more in the busy section, and she had a store where she was selling various designers. And so there was the two of us on the street. We were pretty far apart. She was closer to Bathurst and I was like Queen and Shaw. And so there were the two of us on the street, on the strip, you know, that Queen Street strip. But as far as designer, I was the only one. And then after a while, so I was there for 5 years. Yeah, some people didn't love it because someone sent the police over one time and he came in plain clothes. So I didn't know he was spying, right? He was just like, oh, so what are you doing here? Or da da da. Oh, you're serving, you know, alcohol, because we said, and the restaurant next door, because, you know, when you're in those small strips, you make friends with all the owners. So the next door neighbor was a really popular Italian restaurant and their family was great. And so they would, you know, they would provide the alcohol. Everything was up front, but someone was not happy and sending, you know, the police over to sort of try and shut me down. And then people started to accuse someone, I shouldn't even say this, but someone had the audacity, was like, oh, you're running a brothel, because I had the spa downstairs and I had people coming to get manicures or pedicures. And I was like, how is that? You know, someone was like, oh, it's a cover. It's a cover for something. This is not a real store. It's a cover. So I did get all those me while I was there to make it more challenging, which I don't think someone would say that if there was, you know, to another store owner. It's just, it's so random. Like, I'm throwing a brothel, like I'm selling illegal substances. You know, it's just like, really? I'm selling clothing. So, yeah.
Can you tell me how your Caribbean and African heritage influenced your designs?
My parents, so my dad moved to England, I think at the age of 16. He was in the army and then he lived there for quite, and he was a very, and both my parents were very super stylish and super dapper. Like, if you see the pictures of my dad, it's just like, he was super stylish, you know, and so was my mom. And, you know, we always had to have our hair done. Da, da, da. So that sort of Caribbean way of being, that formality of dressing mixed with what I was inspired by with those old movies, you know, that was what sort of I loved. That I loved the, you know, my grandmother was Venezuelan, and just sort of that energy of being dressed. And, you know, having your earrings and having on a tailored suit or having on a beautiful coat, you know, how West Indians love to dress for an occasion, you know, even now, you know, which is what I love about our culture, because we would always be the most dressed and people would be casual. Like if we went to the theater, you know what I mean? The Canadians would be casual, you know what I mean? And we're like dressed to the nines. But that part of, you know, getting dressed and doing your hair and always having an earring on or always, you know, a little bit of perfume and having your beautiful dress. Like that's the part of my culture that, you know, I wasn't designing tracksuits and t-shirts. That wasn't what I was drawing. It was more the formal dressing was what I loved.
So Miles is in your life. He's been in your life for a while now. Tell me how Miles coming into your life has changed it. How have you changed it?
Well, that's a whole other podcast. But when I had Miles, I was doing my last collection when I found out I was having Miles. So I did my final collection. I think I was 3 months pregnant and no one knew at that time. So it was, and at that collection, I actually did a presentation of a recap of my history of all my collections. I presented a new collection. And then after that, Miles came. And, you know, people say, oh, you're going to be more creative, you know, being pregnant. No, I was exhausted and I was not creative at all. I lost all my creativity. I was exhausted and it made me start to reevaluate. It was sort of like, what am I now? I'm not a designer. I'm a mom. Like all those questions come out of, I find when you have a baby and you become a different person in a way. And then you have to sort of reevaluate what you are, who you are, what you stand for. So I took a break from designing. I was producing fashion shows and doing other things in the space. And then I met at his preschool, I met another mom, another stylish mom. She wasn't into fashion, but she was very social and she was a connector and she liked fashion and stuff. And she had one in preschool And then she was pregnant with her second. And then after he was born, she would bring fabric. She was like, I Googled you. And can you make this? Do you think, like, what could you do with this fabric? I was thinking this bonnet and this. I was like, okay. And so we only had a few hours in between drop off and pick up. And we would look at fabrics and she'd show up with the fabric. And we sort of, do we want to do a bonnet? What about a romper like this? And then after a couple months, we had like 10 pieces. And we're like, is this something? Is this a, what is this? Should we do something with this? And they were cute. And they were basically sort of those classic styles that you see. And so we took it to a friend of hers who had a beautiful children's boutique in Summerhill. And they were like, oh, this is great. You know, we put in an order and you can launch at our shop and we'll give you the window. And yeah, you have like, there was like 5 weeks or something. We're like, what? Like, we don't have a bank. It wasn't a business. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, we had to get a bank account. We had to like, okay, we need labels. Okay, we need patterns. We like, you know, it just came like that. That's how that came about. So that was sort of unexpected twist. But it gave me something to generate and it gave me that boost to start creating again. Like it brought me back to life in the fashion space to develop Petit Genoux. And that's how that came about. It was exciting. I mean, the day of our launch, she was at the store greeting guests and I was still like sewing pieces and I had someone driving them to the store and coming back. Yeah, it was, you know, fashion magic. We made it happen.
You know, I saw your website and I want to say it's a beautiful thing. It really is very light, very airy. I didn't feel constrained in any way. I love the way the babies are all laid out and they all look very contented and happy. So we know that nothing bad happened to the kids while they were modeling these.
No, everyone had their mom there. And those pictures are like captured in between half crying, breastfeeding. It's like a lot going on. And we get those few moments where the babies are happy. Yeah.
So what notable recognitions have you received in the fashion and design industry and how have they impacted your career?
I think the number one thing is that I've always, even when I'm not looking for it or not doing much, I'm always consistently getting press, which I find amazing and great. You know what I mean? You know, all the magazines I can name, I guess, Elle, Fashion, Flair, Toronto Life, The Globe and Mail, Hello Magazine, the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, like, you know, all of them have, I've been recognized them over the course of my career many, 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 many times. And I think that's just because I've been doing it for so long. It's all I've ever done. In between, you know, like if there's a slump, I'll take some other work doing dialing or whatever, but I've always gotten the accolades. And what they do is they just keep me in people's minds. They know what I'm doing, you know. I'm not too much for the awards. And now I've become not a total recluse, but almost a little bit of a recluse where I'm, you know, back then I was out and about and doing all those things all the time. And now I sort of just design and create under the radar just because it's like what I like to do and what I'm good at, you know. It's spread into interior design now as well, but always being in the mind's eye and present, you know, in these publications. I think I have something coming out in El Quebec for Petit Genoux in a couple weeks. But yeah, it just keeps me relevant, I would say, which is a good thing.
I'm curious. Who's Frankie? What is Frankie?
So Frankie is what I created when I opened the boutique. And it's Kendra Francis in reverse. It's the K-E from Kendra and the Fran from Francis. So it's just a little flippy flip of that. And, you know, so many people just remember it. And every time I post something about Frankie, then I could see like the activations on my Facebook. This people are looking for it. So, you know, I do feel like there's a space to bring her back to life in some form, which I am working on right now. And so Frankie is, I think people used to call me Frankie too, even though it's not my name. So when I had the shop, people would call me Frankie. So those are the odd people that know me as Frankie. They don't know me as Kendra. But it's an energy, it's a style, it's a flavor that I created way back when. And it's just sort of alive. It's chic, it's stylish, it's subtle. You know, I really think that when you're wearing something, it shouldn't take over who you are. It should just accentuate who you are, you know, accentuate the positives and stuff like that. It's not really trendy. It's not trendy. You know, it's relevant, but it's not trendy, if you know what I mean.
Yes,
you know, if the trend doesn't fit you, then don't put it on.
Right. You're talking timeless wear.
Timeless.
Contemporary wear.
Yes.
That
yes.
You could wear today and 15 years later, you can still put it absolutely. On and still feel
absolutely.
Relevant.
My sister and my niece are curators. I mean, my niece, I'll see her in something that was a Ryerson project. They still have every single piece. And she can wear them, and she wears something like, oh, that's, I was like, is that mine? Did I make that? You know, she's wearing stuff that's 30, 35 years old, 40 years old, and she's still wearing it. So it's very exciting. I should actually try and collect all those stuff and just see what it looks like. Just
how has social media helped your business, your influence?
Social media is... it's not as easy as it seems. I mean, it's great. It just keeps you relevant. It keeps you in the minds of people, in the eyesights of people. During, you know, lockdown and during the whole BLM movement, that was very helpful because people were out there looking. You know, obviously that's dwindled now, but that sort of brought awareness to the brand a lot more during that time. And so it's not that easy to maneuver, I find. I'm not on there all the time posting like I should be, but it gives you a space for people to see you internationally, for people to see all over the world. It's your calling card. I need to figure out a way to use it better, I have to be honest, and to be more active on it, but it's a whole other job. It's a whole other job. My son is like, Mommy, I'm going to do your social media. So he's great. He's got, you know, tens of thousands of followers on his, I don't know how he does it, but he's, you know, he has a job. He has a job to work on my social media. It's a great tool.
So is there anything that you want to share with our audience that we haven't asked you or that you haven't spoken about? The mic is yours now.
I would just say that throughout the entire history, there's so many parts of fashion that I've touched. You know, I used to teach at the for TFI at 555 Richmond. I used to teach a fashion program for about 5 or 6 years, Fashion 101. It was a program that was funded by the government. So that was a great experience. I had experiences where I did a television show for the W Network where we were making over people, you know, giving them like a makeover. But that was such a positive experience because it just gave me the understanding that when people, the confidence builder that it can be, it took it out of the superficial space of fashion and trends and the runway. And when you see people glow from the inside when they see themselves and they're like, oh, you know, and it's not, you're not changing them. This is not cosmetic surgery. This is not saying, oh, you need to change this or fix that. You know, it's just a matter of like, oh no, you can wear this. It was surprising to me how many people walk around and don't think they can just walk into any store that they want to. You know, they're like, oh no, that's not for me. Oh no, that's too fancy for me. Oh no, I can't. You know, some women we had to like drag. They're like, oh, I would never come in here. I would never like, you know, and then they leave with this second level of like confidence where they're like, oh, okay, I can do this. So, I mean, that is the best part of fashion for me. That's where it can bring light to someone. So that's more what I'm focused on now. And that's why even taking my aesthetic into the home, just showing people like when beauty, when you're surrounded by beautiful things, and beautiful things don't have to be superficial things. You know, when you're surrounded by some sort of form of like organization and, you know, a beautiful pillow or something that's light or lack of clutter, all those things bring a good energy to your life. So that's more what I'm pursuing now, fashion as a way of positive energy, positive environment, you know, boosting and building your inner self.
Thank you so much. We learned so much about you. You are a community builder, a confidence builder. You are all over the place in fashion design, not only just in material, but also uplifting individuals' homes. Your son obviously takes a lot after his mother. With PowerPoint presentations. That is a new one if I've ever heard. But all of these things make you who you are, Kendra. And I just have to say that it was an absolute delight having a conversation with you today. And you know, the next time you come up with your next collection, whether yes. it's fashion or if it happens to be things for the home, please let us know, because we would love to hear about your journey.
I will. Thank you guys so much. This was lovely. You guys are lovely. I appreciate you guys having me.
It's a delight. It's a pleasure. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed having you on Speak Up International. And as Elton said, let us know when you want to talk with us again.
I will. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for listening to Speak Up! International. If you would like to contact fashion designer Kendra Francis, kindly go to her website, www.petitegenou.com. That's spelled PETITSGENOUX.com. Would you like to be interviewed by Speak Up! International? Please drop us a message containing your name, company name, the service you provide to your community, and an email address to info@speakuppodcast.ca. You can reach us using Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. To connect to our podcast, use Spotify or your favorite podcast platform and search for Speak Up! International. You can also find our podcast using our web address, www.speakuppodcast.ca. Our logo has the woman with her finger pointing up, mouth open, speaking up. At Speak Up! International, we aim to inspire, to inform, and to educate.